So we're here outside the Computer History Museum. This is Soren Belsted. I'm Jeremy Strike, not the Igniter Conference with PodSource. And Soren, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. I'm having a great day here. And how about yourself, Jeremy?
Oh, very good. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been a lot of fun. Don't yeah.
So tell us about your company, Agent IQ.
Agent IQ. So Agent IQ is a company that focuses on human-to-human engagement, interaction, building personal relationships, and enabling them at scale. So when I say personal relationships, I mean personal relationship between businesses and individuals. Coming from the idea, I spent the last 10 years providing mobile banking payment services to large organizations. And I've been part of this trend that effectively took customers and got them to leave the branch, go out, never go to the bank branch, only go online, go to mobile. And while that created immense efficiencies and reduced the cost burden of serving customers, what one of the unintended consequences was that because you don't go to the branch anymore, you don't see a person at the branch, you don't have a relationship with the bank anymore. I think it's fair to say people don't have relationship with brands, they have relationship with people that represent brands. So if you think about it, if you are a customer of Bank ABC, if you ask Bank ABC about something or if you're upset about something, you're upset with a brand. But if you have a relationship with an individual within an organization, that allows that individual kind of the opportunity to learn about you, understand your background, and you build a mutual trust and understanding, which makes you a lot more open to listening to your candidate. I give a specific banking example, really. But one of the challenges about personal relationships is that if I'm a bank, I have a million customers. The easy way of building a personal relationship is I'm going to hire a million people, and Jeremy, you're going to have me, and I'm the only one who's ever going to serve you. Scalability is a concern, of course. And if we do, even if you think about it, if I'm your banker, you don't want to talk to me every day. But now and then, there'll be interactions, and there'll be interactions that are high value add. Those are things like you go, hey, I live in a Bay Area and want to buy a house. That's complex, it's expensive, and it's probably the biggest decision, financial decision you may ever make in your life. And that is an area where you need not only data, but you need human empathy and understanding. Now, on the flip side, you may also now and then be asking, hey, you know, what time does the branch open? And what is my routing and transit number? How do I add a payee to my online bill pay? Those are simple questions. And while, you know, I like you and I'll be happy to answer your questions, if you think about a pragmatic use of artificial intelligence, machine learning, natural language processing, would be the ability to, instead of replacing me with a chatbot or virtual assistant, if we put a virtual assistant in the middle, so it's my virtual assistant that is available to you 24/7, you can ask anytime, anything you want. If the virtual assistant is uncertain about anything, I'm not sure how to answer it, or I monitor the conversation, I feel it goes off off the rails, I can interject. So I'm always the backstop. So we're not replacing me with virtual assistant, we're making me more efficient. And the way we do that is really three different ways. The first one is we use artificial intelligence to create a virtual assistant. And the virtual assistant is there to be available to you 24/7. And to deal with low complexity things, things that we don't really need to be in person. We want it to be available to you all the time. And to be honest, we don't want me necessarily to spend time doing that. The second way we use it is if you reach out to a bank or retailer and you have a specific question around shipping or payments or you lost credit cards, you want to talk to the, while I'm your normal banker, you may want to talk to a specific person about a specific issue. So we use AI to understand what is the intent you're expressing and route you to the right person that's available. And the third way is, and that's probably the one that excites me the most, is use AI to make me more effective. So if you ping me and say, hey, you know, 10 o'clock at night, you're watching Naked and Afraid, and your mind wanders because it does when you have watched 10 different naked people running around being hungry. You'll think about this and you go, what do I actually, if I want to buy a house 2 years from now, you know, what do I need to do? And what does mortgage rates look like? Using AI and virtual assistants to make me more effective make a lot of sense. So integrate a virtual assistant into data systems, into knowledge bases, and present information to me. not directly to you, but have it like the virtue, the assistance of 30 years ago, run around, collect all the information around me, suggest responses to you. I can use them or not use them. I can edit them. But also, hey, Jeremy, if you want to know about a variable rate interest or ARM, let me just pull a document here and send it to you. So really use AI to make me more effective and make me better at responding to you.
Interesting. So, you mentioned before about, you know, building relationships and building trust.
Yeah.
So I guess when you have this this information that's served up and you're improving the banker or whoever it is they're interfacing with, right, that actually would contribute to a beneficial relationship and more trust.
That's exactly right.
That's a really interesting concept.
And what we have seen is, we spent a few years in this, what we saw when initially when you start this personal digital, it's a bit of an oxymoron, a personal relationship in the digital world. But think about that. You have that every day with your family, WhatsApp, SMS, et cetera, et cetera. And we think that's the right model for not only banks, but high-end retailers. We feel after a decade of this personalizing service, the pendulum is swinging the other way. Think about local artisanal bread. You don't necessarily buy bread from Starbucks right now, or buy coffee from Starbucks. You buy from the local roastery down on Second Street instead. So I think there's a pendulum swing back to, we want to go back to something local, something personal. And we see for banks, for high-end retailers to stay relevant, that's a path they must follow. And the purpose is not only that I want to have a personal relationship with you, so if I mess up, you don't get angry, but it's also, as a consumer, you never want to have to repeat yourself.
Yeah.
If we want to build 2-3 years knowledge of relationship where I understand where you're coming from, what excites you, what you're interested in. So when you reach out to me, you don't have to tell your whole life story again. Hey, I moved here from You don't want to do that. And the benefit is persistent relationship allows me to build a background and I can be relevant to you. So right now, the interaction I have with my bank is about once every 3 weeks, I get an invitation to open another credit card. that's all I get. So I don't know. I don't think I told you the what triggered this thought in my mind.
Sure.
So I moved to the US about 10 years ago. When I moved, I had newborn twins. We moved up to the Midwest and we worked with a big financial processors and hence were assigned to a specific bank. And I got my personal banker. And you know, usual, I expect I would never see him. But one day I needed to get some documents notarized for my children, for their passports. And I was at the bank, so I just go, hey, Al, how do you notarize in the US? I'm new to this country, I don't know. And he goes, well, you can go to UPS, you can go here, you can there, but I'm a public notary, so I can do it for you. And he went, you know, it's Milwaukee, it was December. And he goes, getting outside with young children is hard now, so you know what? Send me the documents, I'll print them out, I'll pop by your house later, and I'll certify them at your house.
Oh,
interesting. That's a good experience. So I thought, maybe Al is a bit different.
Yeah, and you know, you remember it now.
Exactly. But what then happened, a year later or so, I think, about a year later, I was at the branch, and I had bought a new car, a new-to-me car. And Al came out, and we looked at it, oh, you got a new car, and I got a new car. And we did the guy, we went up, we kicked the tires a bit, and opened the bonnet, and Al goes, so Soren, how did you get the car? Did you buy it? Did you finance it? Did you, you know, did you lease it? And I went, you know, it's just a secondhand car. So I went, no, I bought it. I'm a little bit proud. You know, I just paid it like that, right? Felt a little bit good about that. And I just went, that's great, great sign. But, you know, if you ever want to buy a house, you need a credit score and you are earning good money, you know, my situation, you're earning good money, you're saving well, but you don't have a credit score because you don't have a credit relationship. And I went, the US is the only place in the world that uses this system. So I went, I've never heard of that before. So I asked him, so what do I need to do? I was like, well, a few different things you can do. One option could be, I know you already paid the car, but if you took a $5,000 12 months loan, you're gonna have to pay about $200 in interest because you're gonna get a horrible interest rate because you don't have a credit score. But that would start you on a credit score, and that credit score will essentially just continue improving after this event.
Interesting.
Now, what's interesting about that was So Al has seen me. I'm new to the US, I'm married, and I have fairly newborn twins. That means in the next 2 years, my wife is gonna tell me we're gonna buy a house. Al knew that,
yeah.
And Al was able to be relevant to me. I didn't feel like Al was selling me a loan. So 2 years later, we did wanna buy a house. And we started looking online. We looked at all the mortgage calculators, yada, yada, yada. And we can all do that. But what you don't get from that is a reasonable person's opinion. And at home, I would ask my parents. They don't know anything about US property mm-hmm. market. So I called up Al and said, hey, Al, I've done the calculation myself. But tell me, as a trusted individual, how much should I spend? Mm-hmm. You know what I earn, you know what I've saved, and you kind of, you know who I am. What would be a good amount? And he said, you know what, looking at you, you are a little bit conservative. He said, you should spend, I would suggest spending this much. And mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I'll do that. And Al went from being just my bank to kind of being a trusted advisor. Mm-hmm. So when we bought a house in that price range, I didn't go shopping for mortgages. I didn't go to SoFi or USAA or US Bank or anything like that. I just called Al and said, Al, get me the right mortgage. Because I trusted Al, and a lot of what we do in finances is out of, we don't have as much information as an expert. And there are two things. There's an element of wanting to be delighted, but also there's a risk avoidance. And if I have a relationship with Al, if I trust Al in this scenario, I know that he's not gonna, I believe that he's not gonna trick me, and I'm not gonna walk away feeling like an idiot or feeling that I have been cheated.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And you described it as kind of Tinder for bankers, right?
It is. And yeah. we figured out how do you make this a good interface?
Yeah.
So the what we found was when we experimented with this, you can allow, if people don't go to the branches, I went to the branch to my bank account. That's why I met Al.
Yeah.
Now, if I never went to the branch, and we know online account opening is becoming more and more dominant, so how do you establish that relationship? So what mm-hmm. we built is what we, tongue-in-cheek, call Tinder for banks.
Yeah, that's excellent.
As you go online or in a mobile app, you essentially see profile card of the bankers that are available. They're not avatars, they're real human mm-hmm. beings. And what we found was, instead of describing my background, you know, I graduated from here, I'm really good at credit cards, describe who I am as a human being. Mm. Are you dogs or cats? Are you beets or snow? Are you coffee or tea? Tell me a little bit about yourself, because even the most objective of us needs something to, you know, I'm an engineer by training, so I thought, that doesn't matter to me. And they go, whoa, that guy likes Beatles. Click, that's my person. Mm-hmm. Something to connect about.
Mm, interesting. It's like being a part of the same community.
Exactly right. You have something in common, something you can talk about.
Oh, that's fantastic. So let's shift gears a little bit.
Absolutely.
So just to change the subject.
Yeah.
What was the last thing that gave you like a real belly laugh?
It's the last thing that gave me a belly laugh. Let me see.
So like for me the other day, I'm staying at an Airbnb here.
Yeah.
And there's two dogs and one of them comes in with a pumpkin in its mouth. And I was like, okay, that's weird.
Yeah.
And I took the pumpkin away. And then the Airbnb host comes in and is like, no, that's for him. And gives the pumpkin to the dog and the dog starts eating the pumpkin. So I thought that was bizarre.
That is bizarre. I'll agree with you. Try to think about that. It's probably something my kids did, I would imagine. They tend to be some fairly unique things. I have to think about that.
We'll come back to it. I was lucky enough to catch your talk earlier. So one thing, as a young entrepreneur, and I know there's other people, especially people who are watching, listening to this podcast. So you mentioned top down and bottom up companies.
Yeah.
How do you distinguish between the two? And what do you think would be maybe one good piece of advice for either person as a young founder of one of those companies?
So I think as you set out, of course, the first challenge of any startup is understanding. The first challenge as I see it is mm-hmm. one, solve a problem for somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, don't solve a problem because it's exciting, but be very clear on what is the problem you're solving, who are you solving it for, mm-hmm. and how are you solving it. If you can answer those three questions, you are off to a good start.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is you have to start, as you start thinking about building your pitch deck or building your product, you have to think about how am I going to sell this? So mm-hmm. as somebody formulated, how are you going to make $100 million? Are you going to have 100 customers to pay you $1 million? are you going to have a million customers pay you $100?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very, very interesting distinction because it dictates how you build your company.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some parameters that are worth looking at. And when I say top down, that means you sell to executives in a, in an organization, mm-hmm. sell to C-level or SVPs, high, you know, senior people that think about this strategically and have the mandate and the process to make a, essentially, make a big commitment and push it into the organization.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be a top down. A bottom up would be what I experienced in the past with some of my technology teams, where they started adopting Slack. And they adopted Slack because they thought it was really cool and easy to use.
Yeah.
And it was $5 a user a month, something in that range. So nobody made a decision. Somebody said, hey, I'm just going to get 10 licenses. This is $50. I'll cover it myself. And people started using it and became kind of a pervasive technology within the company until more senior people started going, hey, wait a minute, is that what we're using? Sure, we'll make that. And essentially, the sales process came from individual contributors that used it and kind of permeated up into the organization.
Wow.
Instead of top down, where you start at the top and push it into the organization.
Yeah.
So I think as you think about who you're going to be, there are a handful of questions you can ask yourself to try to ascertain, what am I? Should I be top down or bottom up? And if you think about ultimately a top down product, or the anatomy of top-down product is generally something that's fairly complex, it's fairly expensive, it takes time to implement, it takes time to understand how to use it well. Not one person will just sign off on it on a credit card. So it's a long process, it's a longer journey. Versus a bottom-up would be, for example, if I hit the end user, again, Slack as an example, if I hit the end users, they'll just sign off and start using it. It's simple, there's no implementation, it's low cost, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And why I think that's exceptionally important is because that dictates what do you do when you want to go find your first customers? Mm-hmm. How do you sell? If you want to be a bottom-up, and there's some enormous, there's some great examples, think about, in some ways, G Suite, Zoom, Slack, Stripe, businesses that make it exceptionally easy to sign up.
Mm.
You don't need integration. You go to a website, you enter your credit card, 5 minutes later, you're up and running. Now, if you want to do that, it's about creating a certain type of marketing awareness amongst users, but also you want to think about how do you build a pipeline of 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 customers? And a good way of doing that is using SDR, so sales development representatives that essentially cold emailing, cold calling, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Because that can get you into that journey. Now, on the top down, you know it's going to be complex and it's a longer sales cycle. You probably want to look for a, I'd say, director level salesperson that had sold into your target market space before, speaks the language, has a Rolodex, and understand that to get to a decision maker, it's not enough to get to that person. You need to get to the people below her. You need to get to the people above her, if there are any.
Mm.
You need to essentially surround the person. You need to be able to navigate the organization. So you will not really in that scenario benefit from having a lot of cold calling in SDRs, but you need real kind of account executives that know how to farm an account.
Mm, relationships again.
Relationships in this, absolutely.
All right, Soren, the lights are starting to go out, but this is good. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Kyle.